going to talk about influenza, past and present. Influenza has been around for many, many years, and the history goes back literally thousands of years, we think. Obviously, we can't prove that at this point. Influenza was, we think, first described by good old Hippocrates. In his book of the epidemics, around 400 BC, he mentions a syndrome which we recognize as likely to have been influenza. And it's in his book about epidemics, so that makes sense for influenza because it does come in epidemic form. A Dr. Hirsch in London, about 150 years ago, looked back through more recent history of the past 1,000 years or so, and he tabulated about 300 outbreaks of illness. His techniques were rather poor, and a lot of his studies probably weren't real influenza. But give the guy credit, he did this back in the 1880s, published a book in 1883, and tabulated outbreaks. Probably the majority of them were influenza, but not all of them were, and they can't be proven. The first clearly recognized influenza case, or epidemic, I should say, was in 1510. There was an article published in Clinics of Infectious Disease in 2010, which is the 500th anniversary of that outbreak, which was pretty well documented, by their standards anyway, to have been influenza. And that's an interesting read as well. I'm going to be talking primarily about influenza A, but there are other influenzas which I'll mention. So where does the name influenza come from? This is another bit of history which is fairly interesting. Back in the Middle Ages, people thought that if you had something that bad happened to you, like you became sick, your mule died, it was a visitation from heavens from having had previous bad behavior. You were being punished or there was some retribution. That's not totally true, but it was felt to be a heavenly influence, something that you were getting because you did something known or unknown before. And it was called influenza celestiale. That's Italian. Later on, in the 17th and 18th centuries, they also called this disease influenza del freddo. That's Italian for influence of the cold. So we get that from Latin or Italian. And the name has stuck around. And the spelling is basically unchanged, too, except we dropped the celestial part. So this is an electron microscopic view of influenza A. Influenza A, as you can see, is kind of long, cucumber-shaped virus. Some of the cartoons coming up later will show it more circular, but that's what it looks like under the electron microscope. It's very, very small. It's 1/10,000th of a millimeter, and it can do a lot of damage, as I will discuss in just a little bit here. So in the past 100 years, since the 1918 pandemic, which I'll discuss a little bit more thoroughly, we've learned an awful, awful lot. It's been a subject of investigation by multiple labs all over the world for over 100 years, actually. The very first influenza was actually not known as influenza, but in 1901, there was a disease in birds called the fowl plague, which they were able to identify was not due to a bacteria. They had a filterable material going through old Chamberlain filters, which filtered out bacteria, and that liquid taken from the sick birds could still infect other birds. That was the first hint that it was some kind of a virus. Now, back in that time, they didn't know what a virus was. They couldn't see them. They just knew it was some unseen agent. After all, what does virus mean? Virus comes from the Latin word for poison. And you can see back in the old days how they would have thought that. I'm going to talk about these different subjects in my talk. We've touched on epidemiology, the statistics of the disease, a little clinical description. Clinical description, I won't spend much time on. We all know what the flu is. Treatment options, a little bit of the molecular biology, which is interesting. Viral mutation, there are different ways of mutating or changing. Drift and shift, I'll discuss what those refer to in influenza A. A little bit of history. Birds, swine, and humans, those are the ones that share influenza A. But not every year. And then some other items on immunology and influenza vaccines. Influenza, and this is influenza A we're talking about primarily. In the USA, there are 15 to 20 million cases per year. We don't think about it, but that's a lot of people. That's if we have 300 million people here in the country, that's a lot of influenza. Now, most of it, people get it. You get sick for a few days, you miss work, you get back to work. But worldwide, every year, there's hundreds of millions of cases. A lot of people get pretty sick. probably 500,000 people die as a consequence of influenza. Now, that's usually from complicating factors such as pneumonia, or people who have, you know, weak hearts can have a cardiac arrest. It's not directly due to influenza much these days. Back in 1918, that was a different story, when it was a much more virulent virus. People did die directly from influenza pneumonia back then. So in the USA, 250,000 hospitalizations every year occur because of influenza, directly or indirectly, and quite a few deaths annually, which are usually indirect deaths, like I say, primarily the elderly, primarily from complications. So if you look at all told, all comers, each one of us in the USA has about a 1 in 10,000 risk of death from influenza or complications thereof. That's pretty high when you think about it. Majority of that, is, again, is over 65. So there's a concept called the cost of illness, which epidemiologists and statisticians look at. And if you look at the cost of illness, it has to do with what you pay for your medicines, what it costs for the hospital bill, and all the other costs, like loss of work. 20% of the cost of illness for influenza nowadays, it comes from the cost of medications and hospitalization, et cetera. But 80% of the cost of influenza comes from non-medical costs. That's primarily from not going to work in the working age population, or parents having to take time off because their kids are sick from home from school and they've got to take time off. There's some other costs as well, too. It costs an awful lot of money. Line number three there states how it's the estimated cost with influenza in the USA is $10 billion a year, with a B. if extremely virulent virus like the 1918 strain occurred, there are estimates that it would cost around $700 billion a year and would drop the gross domestic product by 5%, at least temporarily, for a few months. That's an awful lot. So we're talking about some serious stuff here, and the government's interested because it's financial. And I'll mention about that in the coming here. So let's go back about 100 years to 1918 and just kind of look at the 1918 pandemic with the Spanish flu. There are some interesting lessons from 1918 that we can take. It was in the middle of World War I. The USA had gotten into the war about a year and a half earlier, and that was the entire focus of most of the world at that time. Woodrow Wilson was the president. He initially was a pacifist. Then once they got in the war, he was prosecuting the war as hard as possible, and he was very, very determined to win. At that point, as I mentioned, viruses were not very well understood. Everyone thought that the flu was from some kind of a bacteria. Louis Pasteur, Robert Koch, and some of the other early pioneers in microbiology had figured out germ theory, proven that tuberculosis comes from a germ, diphtheria, that sort of thing. But viruses, they didn't understand. They kept looking for a bacteria. It was a record cold winter. As I'll mention later, lower temperatures tend to increase the risk of influenza. We're not sure exactly why, but that is the case. Influenza of 1918 came in three waves, and I'll mention that later. Each wave was slightly different. Back in 1918, the first mention of any influenza issue, other than the routine cases of flu around the country, came out of Kansas, of all places. So nothing out of the ordinary was reported until early 1918. Haskell County, Kansas. Now, that's just west of Dodge City. Here's Dodge City, and just west, roughly in this area, is Haskell County. There was one physician for Haskell County. He had moved there in 1885, from Ohio. He was a bit of a romantic, and he was the only doc in the horse and buggy era for that part of the country. He noticed an increase in severe influenza cases. He was all of a sudden getting called day and night for people on farms and small villages around there, and he was exhausted by taking care of all these sick cases, and there was an increase in mortality as well. Kind of shocked him. His name was Loring Minor. Loring Minor was a tall physician. He was a bit of a romantic. He liked to read Greek books, and he also was a heavy drinker. But he was a dedicated physician. His son was a physician serving in the Navy at that time. And so he actually kept up on some of the latest things because he wanted to keep up with his son. But how would you like to have that on your tombstone? His patients said they'd rather have him drunk than someone else sober. I guess that's a compliment. But he did some very good things at that time. He documented. He reported a large number of cases which he called influenza of severe type. He recognized influenza, and he recognized this was out of the ordinary. He contacted the Public Health Service at that time. He didn't get anywhere. He sent a letter. It actually was published, either the letter or the report, in the Public Health Reports. Now, some of you may know that now as Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which comes out, which the Public Health Reports evolved into. That was the only warning for the first 6 months of 1918. Of course, by the summer of 1918, it was very, very obvious that there was quite an epidemic going. In retrospect, this was suggestive of a new virus adapting to humans. Interestingly, in the veterinary literature from that time, they also noticed an increase in influenza. Remember, swine, birds, and humans can all share influenza A. It's suspected that the influenza A of 1918 originated from birds. And then whether it came to humans first and then to swine or the other way around is probably academic. But back in those days, people lived on farms anyway, in close association with their chickens, with their pigs, with their livestock. They were all together. That's kind of the case in Southeast Asia now, which is sometimes where we think that reassortment occurs in the virus and becomes more virulent potentially. The next outbreak of significance in 1918 occurred in Camp Funston. Camp Funston is in Fort Riley, Kansas, which is just west of Topeka. Here's Topeka. Camp Funston is at the junction of these two rivers forming the Kansas River. It's World War I. Normally there wouldn't be quite so much traffic back and forth, but they were recruiting all kinds of young soldiers from all over the country, including from Haskell County. There was an outbreak in Camp Funston in March of that year, 2 months after it started, or 3 months after it started there in western Kansas. Camp Funston at that time was full of old army barracks. You can see those old buildings there. If you look real closely, there's a Model T on the road. It was home to 56,000 fairly green troops at that time, all basically young men in the ages from 18 to 21 or so. March 4th, 1918, Arthur Mitchell reports to a sick call with what was called the flu. Now, he was a cook, and he'd been serving all the other soldiers in the mess hall for the previous 2 days. As I'll discuss later, influenza is actually contagious and you're shedding virus for the 2 to 3 days before you become symptomatic. So guess what happened? Within a few weeks, over 1,000 soldiers were hospitalized and about half the camp was sick. Now, the timing of the Camp Funston explosion strongly suggests that the influenza outbreak there came from Haskell County. There's really little doubt that that's what happened. Let's move on from that. So what happened? So how did it go from there to the rest of the world? Well, that's a military training camp. They had a lot of soldiers coming and going between there and the East Coast and then getting on board ship and going to Europe. Since it takes a few days to get sick from the virus, a lot of virus was being transmitted before people were symptomatic. Plus, again, they didn't understand this stuff the way we understand it now. We understand this hopefully somewhat better. So that's very interesting. This is actually a picture from Camp Funston. That is not the hospital. This picture here is actually a picture of one of the barracks that's been converted into another infirmary, just filled with beds and cots. In the foreground, you can see an orderly taking somebody's pulse, I think. And they didn't have air conditioning. It was pretty rudimentary, but that was all they had to do. They didn't have much in the way of medicine other than aspirin, morphine, and quinine back in those days. Oh, and digitalis, too. How would you like to have to work in those conditions? And they didn't have very many doctors, too. They had about one doctor per 500 patients. It wasn't easy. Frank Burnett, the Nobel laureate, lived through the pandemic of 1918. He studied influenza most of his career. He got his Nobel Prize in immunology. He was quoted as saying, "The evidence is strongly suggestive that the 1918 pandemic began in the U.S., and that its spread was intimately related to war conditions, especially to the arrival of American troops in France." And from there, it affected the war conditions. Okay, so I'm going to come back to this. Why is it called the Spanish influenza? I'm going to leave you hanging on that for just a second. Let's go back to biology of influenza. Influenza comes in four different types that we know of, A, B, C, and D. Majority of my talk is about influenza A, because that's the killer. Influenza B is a less serious virus. It can affect humans and other animals, as you see there. Influenza B can be serious in people who are compromised. Humans that are compromised, like with COPD, it can cause exacerbation of COPD. If you're immunocompromised, it can also cause a much more serious or prolonged illness. And that can be transmitted to some degree between other animals like ferrets, seals, and whales. Can you imagine a whale with a sneeze? Wow. Influenza C is rarely documented. It tends to only be an illness in children, if it's ever documented. Most of us have immunity to it because we've been exposed as a kid, you know, some brief febrile illness. And a very recently discovered influenza D in cattle has been found. We're not sure what the significance of that is, too. There are other animal species susceptible to influenza. Recently, there was a finding of bat influenza in Central American fruit bats. We don't think that's of much significance to us. Perhaps only Bruce Wayne has to worry about that one. So swine flu, avian flu, Hong Kong flu, flus get their names from either where they come from or what kind of animal they come from, and they can potentially be mild or very serious. Swine flu can be bad. This is a cartoon which we found here. The natural host for influenza A are the bird species. All birds can get influenza A. It reproduces in their gut. It reproduces to a lesser degree in their intestinal tract. It has to do with the sialic acid receptors on the surface of the cells. Since all influenza A originated in birds, all influenza A is either a bird flu or avian flu to start with. This is a schematic of the virus. Let me get my pointer here. So, this virus has 8 pieces of RNA that code for 11 genes in it. 8 separate pieces they can reassort to some degree. The 2 major surface proteins are, the big blue ones here are hemagglutinin, that's the H in the virus, and the N is the neuraminidase, which is the N, the H and the N. So the purpose of these surface proteins on the virus, the hemagglutinin is what binds to the host cell. In humans, it's the respiratory tract. And it binds quite firmly to the sialic acid galactose complex on the surface of cells. And different viruses have different affinities because the hemagglutinin does tend to mutate to some degree. The neuraminidase is an active enzyme. It's kind of a box-shaped head. And on each corner, it has like propeller blades, which can clip off the sialic acid, which releases the virus when it's newly formed from the host cell after it's reproducing. So the neuraminidase, and that's I'll come back to that too, as far as when we talk about which medications affect where. So this is this is 1/10,000th of a millimeter. There are other proteins, of course. There's a transcriptase in there, RNA transcriptase, because the host cell being DNA isn't going to have that, and some other proteins for stability. It's an RNA virus, only 11 genes. How many genes are there in a human genome? Anybody know? Tens of thousands, I think. I don't know. A lot. This has 11 genes. It can kill us. It mutates frequently. Why does it mutate frequently? Well, number one, because it reproduces so fast. Number two, it's an RNA virus. RNA virus is one strand. DNA virus is 2 strands. So RNA viruses mutate more rapidly than a DNA virus, and they also have more prone to error. So RNA viruses mutate more than DNA viruses, which mutate much more than bacteria, which mutate a lot more than multicellular organisms like us. It's estimated that the influenza A virus mutates about 1 out of every 10,000 bases. That's approximately the size of its genome. So that means there's a mutation probably just about every virus. Every virus particle probably has 1 or more mutations. Now, not all of those are viable, and a lot of the mutations probably don't really have significance. But since influenza A does not have a proofreading enzyme, and many RNA viruses do not, that's part of the reason it mutates so rapidly. That makes it very adaptable, too, because it can change. Anybody else know another RNA virus that mutates a lot? Right, Hep C, HIV. And those are sometimes tough to treat. So this leads to the concept of the mutant swarm. Mutant swarm, what does that mean? Well, it could be something out of a zombie movie, but mutant swarm means you have, when every cell that's infected releases the new virion products, there are a lot of mutations in all of them. That's called a mutant swarm, because they're not all the same. How does that change the equation? Well, it can overwhelm the immune system because things are changing slightly. Now, if the mutations are in the hemagglutinin or the neuraminidase on the surface, then that's important because that can lead to antigenic drift. And that's an issue which we've got to cover here. Viral mutation leads to variable virulence. Sometimes the mutations will make it more or less virulent. We see that every year. That's why you got to get a new vaccine every year, because it does change quite a bit. It makes it highly adaptable. Sometimes it's adaptable to cross species. But usually that requires genetic reassortment. Influenza A can occasionally cross species, but it usually requires what we call genetic reassortment. The most recent pandemic influenza, 2009, was a not very virulent virus, but it was contagious. And that came out of Mexico in 2009 with a triple reassortment of avian, swine, and human influenza. So here's what reassortment means. Let me go back. If you have two different influenza viruses that infect a cell at the same time, now, when you think about that, how can that happen? Well, it can happen. It can happen inside one individual because, you know, one cell releases a lot of mutant viruses and they can infect the same cell twice. You can have reassortment. But if you have two different species, let's say you happen to be living in Southeast Asia and you're a farmer that takes care of a lot of chickens and ducks. You can get be exposed to, say, influenza from one of your animals. And let's say your uncle comes from Shanghai and he's got the regular influenza. If you happen to be exposed to those two at the same time, they can reassort their genes within your body. That's what we think happens to cause reassortment, where those RNA pieces can reassort among differing viruses. It's suspected that that's what happened. Again, remember, in rural areas where people, swine, and poultry live together in close conjunction, that's where this stuff happens. We tend to think of that in certain parts of the world, mainly the underdeveloped world, more than anything else. That's what happened in Haskell County, Kansas in 1918, we think. Antigenic drift is the slow change by single or two-point mutations that we see on a regular basis because of the high mutation rate. Antigenic shift is a big change, like what happened in 2009 or especially what happened in 1918. Antigenic drift, like I mentioned, is a small change. This is a schematic showing the hemagglutinin. That's the thing that attaches to the host cell. A drift is a slight change. Doesn't change it too much. And sometimes the immune system will still recognize it. An antigenic shift is a big change. A big change where the entire either hemagglutinin or neuraminidase has changed. Now, there are antigenic shifts also in some of the other proteins, but they don't have as much significance as far as the immune response. So we don't really pay as much attention to that. So drift, small change; shift, big change. This schematic here is a little bit busy, but I'll walk you through it. At the top left here, we have the infecting virus cell, which attaches to the host cell. In the host cell, on the cell surface, the sialic acid attaches to the hemagglutinin of the virus. That forms an endosome. An endosome is then engulfed by the host cell, and then what has to happen here is you have to open up or unwrap the RNA. In order to do so within the endosome, you have to have protons brought into the endosome to acidify the endosome. In so doing, it'll open up or unfold the RNA, and it'll open up and then release the virus RNA. That's transported into the host nucleus, and it fools the host nucleus into producing more RNA. That RNA is then reassembled, forms a bud in the host cell. It even takes some of the host cell membrane to form the new virus membrane. Isn't that a rotten deal? And the neuraminidase, remember we mentioned that, that's the enzyme that cleaves the sialic acid attachment, is required in this stage, because if you don't have neuraminidase acting, then the new virus sticks there and can't get away because it's stuck to the host cell, because the host cell has the sialic acid and the hemagglutinin sticks to it from the new virus. So the neuraminidase is essential for the stage of releasing the new virus particles into the environment. Also, the neuraminidase can cleave sialic acid in mucus, which is essential for it to remain effective too. This is where these two drugs, oseltamivir, which is Tamiflu, and zanamivir work. I'll come back to that in a little bit. There's a lot of complexity here. There's some elegant research that's going into figuring this stuff out. It's much more complicated than I've just mentioned, but that's, in a nutshell, kind of what happens. This is a real picture. So, I've mentioned that influenza A only reproduces in the respiratory tract of humans and swine. It can also reproduce in the GI tract of birds and to a lesser degree the respiratory tract. yes, you can get flu by kissing a pig. Such things have been documented. I'll mention that later. There actually was an outbreak in some county fairs here this past summer in the northern Midwest states. Another thing about influenza, it can actually infect other cells, primarily the white blood cells, the macrophages, the polys, but it cannot reproduce in them, in the host. However, in the white blood cells, it kills them. Now, we know that a case of influenza, along with the clinical syndrome, they often have a low or low normal white blood cell count. When you see that, that's a strong clue. Well, why is that? It's because the virus is killing those cells too. Now, it's temporary, and there's a temporary immune suppression with influenza, and that's part of the explanation. Well, that raises the question, okay, the virus reproduces in our respiratory tract. How can we feel sick all over? I tell residents when I talk to them, I say, well, if it's just a respiratory syndrome, it's not the flu. The flu is a systemic illness, and it really is a systemic illness. But it reproduces only in our respiratory tract. Now, we all recognize the case of influenza. I told you I wouldn't mention much about the clinical syndrome, but headache, fever, myalgias, arthralgia, everything hurts. Patient comes in and tells you, my earlobes hurt, my fingernails hurt, everything hurts. They have a dry cough. Dry cough, it does reproduce respiratory-wise and can cause some dry cough and sore throat. Confusion. The high fever, you can get confused. Has anybody ever had a temperature of 104? You can't think straight. And in elderly, they're out of it. They're very confused, along with the general symptoms. People come in and say they just feel horrible. We've all seen this kind of syndrome, and it happens. These people look bad and sound bad. They're toxic. They're dehydrated. They're febrile. They're confused. In the ER, they probably get a code sepsis called, get some Zosyn and Vanco, and call the PGY3. but it's not just a respiratory illness. It's an all-over illness. That's true. Such things happen. Don't forget the oseltamivir, if you give people that in this time of year. If it's in the right clinical syndrome, think about the flu. It's a clinical diagnosis. So here's why influenza has systemic symptoms. Number one, it kills white blood cells. Actually, that's number one. That's number two, really, but it's the first on my slide. White blood cells release endogenous pyrogens. They have their own dead cell material. That stuff in your bloodstream makes you feel sick. Influenza A is one of the most potent inducers of cytokines, like interferon, interleukin, tumor necrosis factor, and some others. For anybody in this audience who's ever treated people with interferon, some of the GI docs may have done that for hepatitis. I've done that for the same thing. Or hem-onc doctors still use interferon for some reasons. People getting interferon don't like the feeling of it. They feel like they have, quote, the flu. Well, yeah, because that's what the flu does. It makes you have a whole lot of interferon and more, obviously, with the other cytokines. You feel sick as hell. It's awful. Also, the virus rapidly multiplies. A reproduction cycle is about 9 to 10 hours. As a matter of fact, you can become contagious to other people within 12 hours of your exposure. It's fast. So all this happening fast and releasing all these cytokines, you feel really bad. But you don't really feel bad until about day 3. Let's go back to 1918 again for a couple more lessons. Okay, we now know that this was influenza A. It has been designated H1N1, I guess because that was the first really bad one. So they arbitrarily named it that. But back in 1918, they didn't know hemagglutinin, neuraminidase, H1N1, nothing. We now know it was avian origin, but I told you all influenza A is avian origin at one point or another. The 1918-1919 pandemic became the greatest pandemic in the world ever documented. We don't know how many people died. Estimates range between 50 and 100 million people. That's an awful lot of people, especially in 1918. History was different back then. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have TVs. It was quite a different world back then, but it was a very frightening time. In 1 year, it killed more people than the bubonic plague killed all told in all the years. And actually, most of those deaths occurred in about a four-month period in the latter half of 1918. This headline was about halfway through the epidemic. Actually, the USA lost a little over 600,000 people estimated from that. So why was the 1918 influenza so bad? I mentioned some of the facts earlier about the influenza vaccine. The influenza virus, excuse me. They didn't have a vaccine back then. So we talked about antigenic shift and drift. Last week we talked about GERD and NERD. This week it's shift and drift. 1918, there was a double antigenic shift. Both the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase changed. And the previous virus had been an H3N8. They've kind of gone back serologically, at least from blood samples they had from people from prior to that, and realized that. So that was a double antigenic shift. Most of the society did not have immunity to this virus at all. Plus, it was more rapidly replicating. There was lack of immunity. 99% of all the illness and all the deaths were in people less than 65. That is unique to 1918-1919. That has not happened that we know of before or since. It does affect people younger, but the mortality rate was never so high. It was a highly virulent strain, multiplied, and it was just more toxigenic. We think it may have stimulated more cytokine release. Why is that bad? Well, because cytokines can give you an overreaction, inflammatory response. It's felt that a lot of the young soldiers that died from what they called influenza pneumonia died from true influenza rapidly reducing the lungs and causing ARDS. They didn't call it ARDS back then, but that's what it was. The 1918 virus has been found. They found some frozen graves up in northern Norway and also in Alaska. They were able to isolate the virus from that, recreate the genome, and in the laboratory they have, with science, they've recreated it. This virus in animal models reproduces and makes 40,000 as many virions as the currently circulating virus. That was a bad boy back then. So the 1918 virus was doubly bad. It was new antigens, and it reproduced much faster, and for whatever reason, it was much more toxigenic. Back in those days, they didn't understand infectious disease. They didn't know what a virus was. They knew it was something unseen. At that time, they were trying to understand they were trying to isolate bacteria. They were culturing samples, lung specimens, autopsy specimens, and they were recovering a lot of bacteria, mainly strep pneumo and Haemophilus influenza. Now, Haemophilus influenza wasn't called it back then. It actually acquired its name about that time. Dr. Pfeiffer in Germany, who was a student of Robert Koch, famous for Koch's four principles, or Koch or Koch, anyway, he insisted that he had found the bacteria, which he called Bacillus influenza. He was wrong. That later became known as Haemophilus influenza, but he found it in abundance in a lot of people who had died from pneumonia, and but not every single case. And it didn't fulfill his superior's principles of Koch's principles, or postulates, if you name. Anyway, we didn't know what it was. It was poor understanding. Back in 1918, all infectious disease was scary. I mean, you can get strep throat and die back then. You could get pneumonia and die. I mean, nowadays we maybe don't take it for granted, but it's a lot simpler. We got antibiotics nowadays and we have good medical care. Plus, you know, it was much more rural population. People didn't understand so much. Okay, back to the answer for why it was called the Spanish flu. I know you're dying to hear this. Okay, so remember, World War I is going on. The press in this country and in England were asked not to give any negative information. They were asked to downplay all the negative information about the war, particularly, to maintain morale. That was somewhat false because you could open a newspaper and on one page it says, oh, there's been a little bit of illness in the military camp down the road, but nothing to worry about. You turn the page of the newspaper, and there's a full-page ad, you know, crying out for help for anybody with medical experience, a nurse, somebody who's willing to volunteer, please report immediately to so-and-so. So, I mean, people knew what was going on, but the newspapers downplayed it. But in Spain, which was a neutral country, they were not under such restrictions, and they reported about the war, they reported about anything else they wanted to. In the first wave of influenza A, this is May of 1918. Now remember, it started in the January, February in Kansas, and then March and so on, the rest of the U.S., in the first wave. And then some of the soldiers got over to France. They had the first cases of influenza, serious influenza there, in approximately April and May. And then King Alphonse XIII became sick in May. So he is in the first wave. The first wave probably was not the most virulent strain. It mutated a little bit further for the fall of 1918. But he got sick. It was in the newspapers, and that was reported. Okay, so people around the world caught on to this, and that's where the name Spanish flu comes from, because the Spanish newspapers talked about it, and King Alphonse was so sick, and that made headlines for about 10 days or so back in May of 1918. He survived, by the way. Okay, am I going the right way? Okay, I mentioned before that the majority of deaths were all in people under 65. More than half of those were in ages 20 to 40. That's a lot of people in this room right now. The most productive people, parents. The number of orphans left behind in those 2 years is astounding. We don't have figures for that, but there's an awful lot. Estimates of death around the world were 3 to 5%. That's an awful lot of people to pass away. I remember 50 million plus people died. We have no idea how many people really died in India, in Africa, other places. It's just the statistics just aren't there. Even our own Sir William Osler succumbed. Osler was one of the founding physicians for Johns Hopkins. He's one of the doctors we call one of the founders of internal medicine. He was teaching and lecturing in Oxford, England at the time. And in the fall of 1919, which is the third wave, which I'll mention, that's the third wave of influenza A for that year. That was the fall of 1919. He got influenza. He recognized it himself, of course. He got better initially, but then he got sick again. He got pneumonia. Pneumonia was complicated by empyema. He had several procedures done, including thoracentesis, but he never really recovered. About 2 weeks before he died, he's quoted as saying, "I've been watching this case for 2 months, and I'm sorry I shall not see the postmortem." That's Sir William Osler. He passed away at the very end of December of that year. In the years following that pandemic of 1918-1919, there was a syndrome of basically being wiped out. People just didn't fully recover. They didn't have their pep. They didn't have their energy. They couldn't think straight. There was given actually a diagnosis called encephalitis lethargica. We recognize that as a post-viral syndrome, which we now call post-influenza asthenia. Basically, it takes a while to recover from these. You may get over the virus, but it leaves you whipped. In some people, that kind of syndrome can last for a long time. This chart here demonstrates the mortality curve in 1918-1919 compared to other years. Now, in the chart, the data is from 1911 to 1917, but you'll notice that the mortality is for most years is generally in the very young and then the over 65. In 1918, the mortality curve had a big spike in the 20 to 40 age group. That hasn't happened since that time. That was the only, and 1919 actually returned closer to the normal, but not quite. So there's something very unique about that virus. How is this virus transmitted? Well, we all know coughing and sneezing, but there are three types of transmission that are talked about. Large particle, small particle, and then direct contact, which is hand-to-hand or hand-to-face. Large particles are when you sneeze. That's actually the spit, the mucus, the stuff that comes out, and that's pretty much directly, you can inhale that for the first minute or two in the air. Most of that falls to the floor and is over with pretty quick. However, sneezing carries an awful lot of virus. The numbers up there are pretty impressive. And I'll show you a picture. I'll show you a picture right now. Here's one of the residents sneezing. Okay, there's an awful lot of stuff there. I'll come back to that. So 30 to 40,000 particles in a sneeze, 500,000 virions, influenza A pieces, in one sneeze. Imagine that. So that can come directly to you. Also, small particle is an aerosol. Some of the virus stays suspended in the air, kind of like other viruses can do that, like tuberculosis can do that, can remain suspended in the air. And that can remain suspended for hours, and you can inhale that and become infected. However, probably the most common way of influenza being spread is direct contact, hand to face, where you touch something that has it on it, a countertop, a doorknob, you shake hands with somebody who just coughed into their hand. The influenza survives for a while on hard surfaces. Hard surfaces meaning like doorknobs, counter surfaces, keyboards. Keep that in mind. 1 to 2 days. It can last for a while. If there's mucus present, if there's actually some dried mucus, that tends to protect the virus, and it can last even longer, up to 2 weeks. There was an interesting study. They studied banknotes, dollar bills, and they found that a dollar bill that had influenza A that someone had coughed on, if it had mucus on it, would last 17 days. On average, sometimes longer, but average is 17 days. So 2 weeks is probably a possibility if there's some dried mucus with it. I mean, that's kind of disgusting right there, but that's true. human skin, it doesn't last very long at all. For some reason, it doesn't like human skin. It likes your respiratory tract, but not your skin. It lasts only a few minutes on human skin. As I mentioned before, they recovered virus from frozen bodies from 1918 that had been buried in northern Norway. If it's frozen, it lasts indefinitely. That may have something to do with why it's transmitted more in the wintertime. Maybe outside it just lasts out there until somebody touches it. Okay, back to the slide here. Viral shedding. As I mentioned before, the reproduction of the virus takes about 9 to 10 hours in the cell. So about 12 hours after initial infection, you can be contagious to other people. That's fast. You don't feel sick at that point. You start feeling sick about day 2.5 to 3. The peak of viral shedding is at about 48 hours, 2 days or so. These are all from volunteer studies, but it's been reproduced multiple times. The symptoms usually start roughly on day 3. But by day 3, you've been shedding and infecting other people potentially for a couple of days. That's what makes this so difficult. One other thing that was very interesting is that in these volunteer studies, now volunteer studies, you know what they all are. That's probably medical students or residents that volunteer. They get a few bucks to do this study. 33% that actually got documented infections, recoverable virus from the respiratory secretions, and developed neutralizing antibodies to the select virus, 33% were relatively asymptomatic. How do you protect against that? Someone shows up to work, they could have the flu, and they have almost no symptoms. That's a problem. So what does this mean? That means you can't fully protect yourself unless you get vaccinated, because you never know. You never know. Somebody in this room right now might have influenza A. You just don't know it. Another question, why is influenza seasonal? In the Northern Hemisphere, it's in October to April. In the Southern Hemisphere, it's May to September. In the tropics, it's not quite as high a degree of infection, but it's year-round. Why is that? Well, the short answer is we don't know, but I'll give you the long answer too. Airborne survivability is increased in cold temperatures and low humidity. That's been shown multiple times before. In animal models of guinea pigs, it's shown that the infectiousness of the virus is double or triple when you have lower humidity and colder temperatures of the environment. Ultraviolet light, there's less ultraviolet light in the wintertime. Does that have something to do with it? Well, we know UV light can sterilize things. Maybe that's it. Vitamin D levels, well, that's true. Vitamin D levels drop in humans because there's less light also in the wintertime. We have more crowding, more wintertime indoor activities. Schools are in session. The answer is we really don't know, but there is seasonal variation. How do we test for influenza? We all know the rapid nasopharyngeal swab. We do that in the ER and in the hospital all the time. That's a little disappointing when you look at the sensitivity of that test. It's only about 2/3 sensitive. A number of studies have looked at it, and the range is anywhere from 50 to 90%. 90% is probably ideal circumstances, probably not realistic. So a good round, and the average is about 65%, so 2/3. So keep that in mind when you're testing somebody for influenza, that if you really think it's influenza, if it's the right clinical syndrome, it probably is influenza. You should repeat the study, repeat the swab in 6 to 12 hours. The PCR test is a very good test. We don't do it here. It's very expensive. If you send it out, you've lost your chance for any kind of rapid diagnosis. But it can be used for confirmation if you really, really think about a case. Viral culture is the gold standard. Again, that takes a long time to get a result back, usually 10 days or more. But that's used for research more than anything else or for confirmation. We don't do that hardly at all here because by the time you get an answer back, the person's either recovered or you know what it is already. So influenza is a clinical diagnosis. You know, Loring Minor, back in 1918, he did not need a swab to make a diagnosis. When they show up in the ER and you think they got flu in the right time of year, they probably do have the flu. Let me touch a little bit on vaccines. There are a whole bunch of different vaccines out there. The three main ones are the ones listed up here. IIV3, that stands for inactivated influenza vaccine 3, or trivalent. And the three that are primarily used around the country here are the trivalent and the high-dose trivalent, and then the fairly new quadrivalent. There are some other vaccines out there, including the recombinant adjuvant. There's an egg-free one for people who might be allergic to eggs, which is extremely rare. And then the LAIV, which is called live attenuated influenza vaccine. The LAIV is not recommended right now. It seems to have lower immunogenicity. That's primarily in children. And it's not recommended by the ACIP or the CDC or anybody else right now. And it probably is hard to find. I don't think I've ever actually given it to somebody. So we'll talk about the three vaccines here and the preferences we have for them. They're all readily available. There was actually an article in the New England Journal of Medicine for September 29th, so just a couple weeks ago, September 29th, there's an article by Dr. Trainer who studies influenza and reviews the influenza vaccine data. You'd find that very interesting. You don't have to read it because I did, and here it is. The annual effectiveness of vaccines ranges from 10 to 70%. It depends upon the match of the vaccine to the virus that fall. Sometimes they have to get started 6 to 10 months before the flu season, so they're guessing a little bit. Where do they get the viruses from? Where do they get the target viruses? Well, the World Health Organization knows from experience where the viruses come from. Southeast Asia is usually the guilty party, but not always. 2009, it was Mexico. 1918, it was Kansas. The strains are picked in February. February, that's a long time in advance, so there is a bit of educated guesswork going on here. They make the vaccines in embryonated chicken eggs, and it takes quite a few months to get those millions of vaccines ready for people. So which vaccine should you give people? I mentioned the three ones that are most commonly used. The other ones are a bit more esoteric, and you can ask me afterwards about those for when you might want to use those. The Advisory Council for Immunization Practice, the ACIP, gives no preference. CDC, same thing. They don't want to recommend anyone. If you look at UpToDate, they actually recommend that the high dose is recommended for people over 65. The reason for that is that the high dose is a bit more immunogenic. You get higher titers of antibodies. Now, that hasn't really been proven to be more protective, but intuitively, it sounds like higher antibody titers are going to be more protective. If you're on a statin, statin drugs can be immunomodulating. We know that. And being on a statin actually can reduce the effectiveness of the influenza vaccine as far as measured by titers developed. Again, that hasn't been clinically studied to see if that actually protects you any more or less, but intuitively it makes sense. Therefore, since the high-dose influenza vaccine certainly isn't any worse than the regular dose, and it may be better, and it's no more harmful, you might as well use it for over 65. So that's the recommendation, and that's UpToDate's recommendation, and now that I've studied up on it, it's my recommendation for over 65. But in reality, what Dr. Trainer comes down to say in his summary is that the availability of a specific vaccine is the determining factor, meaning whatever you have on the shelf. If you're in the clinic, you're in your office, and you got, you know, Mrs. Smith there, she's 75 years old, whatever you have, give it to her, because they're all pretty much about the same. The advantage of the high dose is small, probably real, but small. So if you've got them in your office, give them the vaccine. Don't let them get away. People will give you comments as to why they don't want to get the vaccine. They're worried about it. Local reactions, 10 to 50%, you know, local shot reaction, very common, go away. Systemic symptoms, feeling a little run down, maybe a fever for a couple days, no difference from placebo. I have heard so many times people say, oh, I got the flu shot and I got the flu right away, or I got a reaction to it. Well, yeah, but you know, viruses are out there that get people sick all the time anyway. That's not statistically significant different. Guillain-Barré is the big one that people get worried about. The risk with the influenza vaccine for Guillain-Barré syndrome is about 1 in 1,000,000. There are multiple studies on that. Most of them are all retrospective or statistical, but there are two references for that on this article here. So what's the risk if you get the flu? Because you have to compare both arms. The risk for Guillain-Barré syndrome in the USA for all of us, all comers, is about 10 to 20 per million. That's just by being in this country. If you get the flu, it doubles that. It gives you an additional about 1 in 100,000 or 10 in a million risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome. If you get the flu in the USA, as I mentioned before, the risk of death is about 1 in 10,000. So yeah, it's a bit of a statistical balance. You've got to take your chances, but I think the odds favor getting a flu shot as opposed to not. One last thing on influenza vaccine. Influenza vaccine is totally safe in pregnancy. If you get the flu, if a woman gets the flu and she's pregnant, the risk of fetal loss is double what it otherwise would be. And the risk of fetal malformation, meaning the baby survives but may be malformed, is about 4 times greater. So getting the flu when you're pregnant is a bad thing. It may be the flu, it may be the high fever associated with the neural tube defects, but that's well known. Okay, here's the virus again. Remember, the blue is the hemagglutinin that sticks to the sialic acid of the receptor cell, and the yellow is the neuraminidase. What do we have to treat? Well, we have two classes of medications to treat influenza. I think most of you know this stuff already. and I'll show you a schematic, in the same schematic that I had before, in just a minute here. Amantadine and rimantadine are M2 inhibitors. M2 is a protein that helps to acidify the environment to release the RNA from the virus. Amantadine, we hardly ever use anymore. It has some central nervous system side effects, particularly in the elderly. It accumulates in poor renal function, and we don't like to use that. Rimantadine has few side effects. In reality, we don't use these drugs very much anymore anyhow because there's more resistance. Amantadine you can get in Southeast Asia for about $1 per kilogram. People give it to their chickens and ducks because they don't want their chickens and ducks to get influenza. And it works. But guess what? Resistance develops. So that's in Southeast Asia. You probably didn't know that, did you? It's like giving antibiotics to feed animals here in the USA. We do that here. It's the same idea. Let's talk about the neuraminidase inhibitors, oseltamivir and zanamivir. They're both similarly effective, take about a 5-day course. Oseltamivir has really no side effects, a very safe drug. You should have a low threshold for treating people with this. Zanamivir is a powder for inhalation, a little more of a hassle. People have to cooperate. Some people do get bronchospasm with it. Remember, if they have some of that respiratory symptom already, giving them an inhalation can make them feel bad. Back to this slide again. Okay, so the M2 protein, which acidifies the endosome, is what you block with amantadine and ramantadine. And then release of the virus from the cell surface is what the neuraminidase inhibitors block. Both of them are effective when the virus is sensitive. So what if an influenza strain with the equivalent virulence to 1918 happened today? It's felt it would kill between 50 and 90 million people. Now, that's probably about what happened in 1918. But we have modern science. We've got ICUs. We've got residents. 50 to 90 million people around the world, that's a lot of people. And that's by today's estimate. And there's a reference for that. So the World Health Organization has influenza as a top priority. This picture here is of a fellow working with the recombinant 1918 vaccine. So you can see he's got the respirator helmet on. He doesn't want to inhale that stuff. It's interesting to note that the 1918 strain of influenza A is actually pretty similar to what we have today. It's only 8 amino acids different, on average, from the circulating influenza A we have today. This picture is a bunch of policemen in Chicago in the fall of 1918. Some of them aren't wearing their masks right. In fact, masks being worn, that habit began in 1918, or things like that. I want to run through a couple other influenzas real quick, and then we'll wrap up here. The H5N1 avian flu, which was kind of a big to-do a few years ago in Southeast Asia, killed a few people, but only people who were exposed to poultry, sick and dying poultry. But now H5N1 is around the world because it's in birds. We have it here in the USA. We have it in birds here in the USA. There's some other ones up there which I'm not going to mention, except for the last one, H3N2. August 2016, how long ago was that? That's 2 months ago. Here in the USA, in the Midwest, there were 18 cases. These are all associated with livestock fairs, where people go to their county fair and they have their horses and their pigs and things like that. There are 18 cases. Michigan, 12. Ohio, 6. That sounds like a football score. But luckily, this does not transmit human to human yet. But remember, we talked about reassortment. It can potentially adapt. You never know. The H5N1 that I talked about, that's the one that's in birds around the world. You have to have a large inoculum. It has to get past your mucus, your IgA, all of your natural defenses, because H5N1 prefers to reproduce further down the lungs. Remember, the sialic acid receptors are somewhat different in different parts of the body in different animals, whereas the current one that's circulating in the world, the primary one is H1N1, tends to attach to the upper respiratory tract more likely. So that's part of the difference. Okay, this concludes my talk. I want to let you know that we do have a few lessons from 1918. We've got a lot way to go. We've been studying this disease for 100 years. Here's an old sign from a trolley car in 1918. I want to recommend all you get a flu shot. Thank you for your attention. Question? There's no contraindication. It should not have an effect on the vaccine, no. So go ahead. I don't know what the Parkinsonian syndrome is being a complication of influenza lately, but there was an awful lot of information that came out, particularly following the 1918 pandemic, about neurological complications, partly from the virus and partly from the high fever that people had, probably. But yes, there's actually quite a bit of information on that. I didn't really bring that up. But yes, there are neurological consequences to influenza. Kids that get influenza, they get a high fever. Is it the influenza or is it the high fever? There can be neurological complications, just like there is in meningitis. If you look at the pathological reports from the 1918-1919 epidemic, and they had an awful lot of pathology. Remember, they did postmortems back then. We don't do those anymore. The brain tissue and neurological tissue was almost always diseased, so they found it there.
That's located in the meningitis.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a neurotropic virus, but when it's overwhelming, your whole body is affected. In the back, question. Yeah, there's an awful lot more information that I didn't have time to address, but some of the horror stories you read from 1918, 1919 about almost Ebola-like type disease where you're bleeding to death, hemorrhaging, blood pouring on the floor. There's a story of, more than one story about someone showing up to work well in the morning and being dead by sunset. I mean, documented, I mean, who knows the real data, but there's no doubt that such things happened. The fear that went along with those 2 years was astounding. When you read these reports, it's just like something nightmarish. Since the risk is about 1 in 1,000,000, there's just not enough data to say. I actually tried to find that. The ACIP recommends that even if you got Guillain-Barré with the previous flu shot, you should still get another one.
Really?
ACIP says that. I may not advise to do so, but ACIP says go ahead and do it, that the chances are small.
So a pregnant mom that gets a flu shot and delivers, the protection is afforded to the baby as well?
I would assume so, at least for a while. Yeah.
So that's a good idea to do that.
Yeah. All right, thanks again. Thank you. Yeah.
I
enjoyed getting ready to ready for it.
Okay, time to go to work.
Okay, get your flu shot. Okay, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for coming. Yeah, I had some fun putting it together.
Wrong place for a shot. Enjoyed it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for paying attention.
Very nice job.
Okay.
Excellently done.
I figured the older folks might appreciate some of the fun slides.
Well, that book on the influenza. Good book, even for non-infectious.
Oh, yeah. This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know I had a lot of that stuff until I read it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I met the author.
The Spanish flu. I mean, you know, and then it turns out it's basically...
It's the Kansas flu.
Transmitted by U.S. soldiers.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, yeah. And the studies that went into... See, I've got a signed copy.
Oh, cool.
I got this from about 4 years ago or something like that. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.